Hello, Joshua.
Hello, David.
Welcome to Lennox Crazy Podcast. Everybody, today I'm pleased to introduce to all of you Joshua Jackson, Sunem Gentoo Developer. Joshua is a member of the Board of Trustees and its treasurer. Is Gentoo your first open source project?
It is the first one that I've actively participated in as a developer or a member who contributed to it. I've been working with open source for off and on for about 10 years now, though.
How long have you been a Gentoo user?
I've been a Gentoo user since about 2003. I was working as a encoder for another group doing fan subs, and was talking to some people about Linuxgen because I had used Red Hat version 5, I believe it was 4 or 5. It had been way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was talking about Linuxgen, wanting to get back into it to give it a try again, and someone had mentioned Gentoo, so I gave it a try and installed it on a P3500. So that's how I started in Gentoo and became a user in 2002-2003.
How did you do on your first install? Did you do it the first time through?
Oh, no, most definitely not. I definitely had to do the install, I think, two or three times to get it correct fully all the way through. Being, you know, a typical guy, you know, I'm like, instructions? I don't need no instructions. And I found out, the instructions are somewhat important.
Yeah, first time I was going to cut corners. So the next time when I failed miserably, I printed out the entire handbook. And then once I did it step by step like they told me to do it, it worked out just fine.
Yep, exactly.
How did you come up with the nick? If I'm pronouncing it correctly, Sunem.
I was going to say, that's a little bit of a story. It goes back all the way to about 92, 91. More or less, you know, back then, it was dial-up modems, the 28.8K at the time. You know, you would connect to BBSs, because literally that was pretty much all that there was. And you know, you'd log in and you'd have the bulletin board systems and that kind of stuff and post and chat with people. And more or less, I needed to come up with a nickname. And I've always had a love of the ocean. So
mm-hmm.
Thinking about the ocean and, you know, just, you know, forces of nature, I thought of tsunamis,
mm-hmm.
which are not a normal occurrence in, you know, the Western culture, you know, in Eastern cultures it happens a lot more often, and I thought about that and went, you know, tsunami is going to be a very common, you know, nickname probably, so I dropped the I and
mm-hmm.
became Sunam. So that's how I came up with my nickname.
Cool. How and where have you implemented Gentoo, and why was it chosen?
It depends on the job, actually. At home, it is my file server, web server, mail server. It serves kind of all those functions. It is also off and on occasionally a recording station for TV or whatever I have. It just varies on that. I use Gentoo as my primary OS at work as well. I've done that for about 4 years now, where I've used Gentoo at work as my primary OS, so I've been very fortunate in having understanding employers and allowing me to use Linux as an OS as long as I can do all required functions of the business, which has always proved to have some interesting problems working with a Windows environment. So, but, you know, that's certainly stuff that we can get into the fun of all that. Beyond that, for employers, I've implemented it as mail servers, I've done it as a web server. I've kind of used it in all sorts of categories.
I have been learning Python as my first programming language. How did you start programming, and do you get to do it much anymore?
I really don't consider myself a programmer, so to speak. To me, when I think of programmers, it's always people who do, C, C++, very much compiled languages. Now, Python you can compile, but, for the most part, it's an interpreted language. And not to discredit them as programming languages, but it's just my personal thinking of, writing in Python, writing in Perl, writing in PHP, writing in Ruby, Bash. All those are more to me scripting languages.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider myself more of a scripter. How I got started on doing that was necessity. It came about because, I needed to do something. I'm like, there's got to be a better way than doing the same exact thing 100 different times for 100, different files or whatever it was that I was doing. And, just looking at it and being like, okay, let me get started and see how I can put this into a loop. And, just writing, something very simple, very crude, and, Bash, and getting the desired result that I wanted. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I need to do this more often. And as I've grown in my abilities with Linux, I continue to use, scripting more and more for trying to automate repetitive tasks. And I'll often do kind of one-off scripts that I don't keep. For the one-off kind of situations that I do, and majority of the time they actually end up being in Bash for simplicity's sake, because that's by far the language that I know best. But I know enough Python to get myself into trouble, and I know enough Perl to get myself into trouble more than anything. Majority of my abilities when it comes to programming is actually being able to read and understand code. I find myself having a much easier ability to look at what someone else has done, understand it, and be able to modify it than I do if I was to have to come up with the same exact thing as that person had written. So a lot of times I'll kind of base what I do off of what a lot of other people have done that are similar, but not quite exactly what I want. So,
what motivated you to become a Gentoo developer?
There's a little history there too. Had a friend, Compner, who now works for on Polydis, and he was a good friend, and I talked to him quite a bit, and he was a Gentoo developer, and I was just talking, off and on about, I really want to give back and just, give to the community that I've learned so much from and, have benefited from, in my growing as a Linux user and everything else. And, I kind of debated about, becoming a developer or not because, at the time my skill set was still kind of fairly minimal. It was basically the next day, Compner Saleem came back and had basically said, I put in a bug for you, and you're going to become a developer.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of went, oh, okay. So the decision was actually kind of made for me.
What aspects of Gentoo do you feel the developers and maintainers have gotten right?
The e-build system, most definitely. I would also say the from source nature, it's kind of given us a unique place within the open source environment, it allows people to build systems the way that they want to build them. No two Gentoo systems are pretty much identical. Every user has the ability to have, native language support if they want. They can not have native language support. They can have LDAP integration if they want, or if they don't ever deal with Windows environments, they don't build stuff with LDAP support. That ability to customize is something that's very, very unique to Gen 2 and Gen 2, you know, based distributions. Because, you know, all of your binary distributions, ultimately, some developer makes the choice for you as to what should be included, you know, that would be for the vast majority of users. Then ultimately, if you are one of the unique users who are not, you know, in that group of categories and you need something else from the program, you ultimately have to figure out how to compile something on those distributions. And unfortunately, a lot of times they're not as easy as you would hope they would be because it just falls outside of the tools that they have available. So that's certainly one of the areas that Gen 2 has gotten right for, you know, where it's at. Beyond that, I think our ability to make your own distribution, it's still in its infancy, really, and, you know, it's constantly under development, Catalyst being that tool. And I work with a couple of guys who work on it and, you know, GenKernel and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, just looking at what they're trying to do and, you know, make easy for people to build their own distributions. You know, because ultimately working in a corporation, you always have custom requirements. And providing a environment that allows you to do that and, you know, make it easy and you pop in a CD, you install, and it's exactly what you need is going to make the system administrator's jobs just far easier. So it's something that's, you know, developed and continues to be developed, you know, slowly, unfortunately, because, well, you know, corporate environments with open source is kind of new and, you know, it slowly grows, but, you know, there's just that difference in mantra, so to speak, of expectations and what you can do and what you see. So I think that's kind of the main areas that I would think of because, you know, I work in corporations, so I kind of look at open source from that kind of perspective.
Yeah, I saw where Cuba, I guess, has implemented their own operating system based on Gen 2, and I can see how it would work because they could set up their the programs from Portage would only install whatever programs that they wanted to install within the entire country, really, if they wanted to. I don't know how they would do that, but
there's a couple of ways to do that. One of the beauties of Gen 2 also is that you can build binary packages. So really, you can have, you know, a main basically build system, build environment that builds all your packages for all your tertiary servers. So really, they don't need GCC. They don't need, you know, any of those tools installed on those other servers. They just need the ability to do, you know, emerge with a binary package, and you don't spend time compiling on these servers. You don't have downtime. You just basically have very similar to an RPM, ultimately. So that's how a lot of people end up ultimately doing it, is using basically a build node, a build cluster that builds the binaries for 32-bit or 64 for whatever environment that they need. So.
Cool. What is it about Gen 2 you would like to see improved?
There's always a lot of things that I would like to see improved. I've bounced around on many projects within Gen 2. I've been in user relations. I've been in developer relations. I've been related to trustees, you know, for a number of years by, you know, poking them, prodding them, previously becoming a trustee, you know, to get them to work on things. I've been the lead of the x86 Arch team after Halcyon stepped down, which is Mark, took that over, and, you know, it was one of the major things that the Arch teams was designed for was to improve stability of the regular Arch trees, because unfortunately, you know, with our kind of loose-knit developer community, you know, there's no kind of unifying direction. So, and I totally went off tangent on the question. I forgot what the question was.
Yeah. What is it about Gentoo you would like to see improved?
Okay. So actually that was going into a direction I wanted to go to.
Right.
A universal direction, which I don't think we'll ever get to. I'd be happy with having a couple of dedicated directions. Gentoo is, as I said, a loose collection of people who happen to kind of come around a common product. And with that, you know, you kind of have people going off in 12 million different directions all at the same time. And unfortunately, while that has benefits, because, you know, we do well on embedded, we do well in servers, we do well on desktops, you know, there's no kind of unifying goal for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So some kind of goal would be really, really beneficial. Beyond that, I think just communication is another area that is always in need of improvement. Unfortunately, a lot of engineers and a lot of, you know, computer programmers and, you know, basically people who would be involved in, you know, open source projects do not always have the best communication skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've all been loners or, you know, people who don't get along with people and don't know how to communicate well. And that causes a lot of misunderstandings, both between developers and between developers and users. So that's another area that can be improved, and that's just a long, slow process to improve, because people need to want to improve and change and, you know, provide information and get people involved. And, you know, yes, open source is collaborative, but people are also, by their nature, very protective of stuff as well. So you need to be able to work efficiently with other people and kind of let go and share responsibility. So,
could you explain a little bit about the Gentoo Foundation and about your role on the Board of Trustees?
Absolutely. The foundation is basically the business side of Gentoo. We have many, many great users, many, many great corporations that contribute to us via, you know, money or donations or in some way that, you know, is not code-based. So there is, you know, accountability and that kind of stuff that you have to go through, which is, for most people, a very, very boring, you know, issue. And, you know, basically the foundation does the business side. So we take care of any kind of legal related issues, which do occasionally creep up. Licensing, for example, for stores, you know, they come to us and, you know, want to sell Gentoo based merchandise. So, you know, have to go through processes of protecting the Gentoo logo, the Gentoo name, and all that in these various places, and, you know, doing the request through that. You know, occasionally people want to talk, you know, about, you know, this license and how the software can be installed and that kind of stuff. So we act as a body for people who come talk to us about, you know, any legal ramifications of that, because ultimately, you know, everyone volunteers for Gentoo, and, you know, no one wants to be sued because of working on an open source project. So we kind of assist in that way as well. And ultimately, we try to just protect Gentoo itself, both the name, you know, the distribution, and, you know, just all the people that work on it. So that's kind of what the foundation is about. As to what exactly I do, I am the treasurer of the foundation, so I get to deal with all the fun banking issues and the IRS and everything else. And that's actually been a very long, involved process for a number of reasons. as many of the users are aware who have been in the open source area for a while, know that for a while the foundation was not in good shape. It ended up on Flashdot. Daniel Robbins, talked about wanting the foundation back, all sorts of things. Since that time, a lot of things have improved, but it's been a lot of slow work, especially on the financial side. Part of it was the fact that the bank that we had been with, NetBank, had been taken over by the FDIC back in 2007. And the foundation kind of went kind of meh for a while at that time as well. The funds were eventually transferred over to ING Direct, and it took a while for me to get caught up on everything else and get even an initial bank account set up, because working with an international organization, funds coming in from international sources and all that, banks tend to have an issue accepting international donations or doing international transactions and all that. So, you have to be very particular about the banks you do and look at the fee structures and everything else. So, doing that, we got an initial bank account done, and then I was able to start focusing on the ING FDIC related matters with NetBank. So I'm still working on that currently. It's been a bit of fun back and forth, partially because ING says they've transferred the funds to the FDIC already. FDIC, after finding out who I needed to talk to, because the FDIC actually has individuals who are in charge of particular banks that have been taken over by the FDIC and getting your funds out. So it took a while to get in contact with the person who was that and finding out, no, we have not accepted any funds from ING for the NetBank stuff, which sent me back towards ING Direct again. And as part of that, getting the count back after I got back to ING Direct, they require lots of paperwork, as all banks do. One of the most recent is the original Articles of Incorporation. So I'm going through a process of getting a copy of those so that we can digitize them as well, because unfortunately not all the records, were kept in an appropriate way and easily accessible, because, it would be with Grant or one of the original founders, or Daniel, or our lawyer. We're checking with him to see what he has as well. Who's also a registered agent, actually, and all that, but I'm dealing with the state of New Mexico to get a copy of the original Articles of Incorporation. So, there's just tying up, all sorts of kind of, I wouldn't say loose ends, but kind of the unknowns of having people who have never run a business, running a business, and what you need to keep and how important it is and all that, getting that all collected together. So once that gets settled, we should have all our finances together, and then we can start actually working on using the money that, our sponsors have given us to improving Gen 2 on the infrastructure side and development and, any of those kind of projects that, we ultimately want to do as a organization. So, and, it's something that we're hoping to start doing in the next fiscal year, which starts actually next month. We have a slightly funky fiscal year, and I actually need to update the previous summaries and update with the new current ones, because our fiscal year is actually from July 1st to June 30th, whereas most people would assume it's January 1st to December 31st and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But nope. As with everything else, Gen 2 does things a little bit differently.
I know PayPal is giving you a run around too, also around the same time. I guess they were waiting for you to get the official bank and all that.
Yeah, that was a bit of a nightmare as well. So, as people were probably also aware, for a while we were not able to accept donations from PayPal. I've worked with PayPal for Gen 2 at least a year now, and in that time, I've had to provide four separate times different information that they've set basically new moving targets for what you have to do to prove that you are a legal entity and all this. So the last one was obviously related to banking, which gave us, you know, big push for banking related stuff and all that. So, I mean, that was a good thing that, you know, in a way it happened because it pushed the banking stuff to a much higher priority. But, you know, it did cause issues with people being able to donate and all that. So that's been resolved with PayPal, but I suspect that we will again have issues with PayPal at a later date when they decide that they need more or different information than they have currently. And oddly enough, with PayPal, they don't seem to have a good system for acknowledging these type of things that they request. So part of the problem was that I had submitted some data that they had requested previously, and I'm like, called them up, I'm like, you guys have this data already? And they're like, oh, yeah, we do. And, you know, they acknowledge it through the phone, and, you know, say they're putting in records into their system about it, but you go log into the website again, and they still request that information. So, I mean, even in large corporate environments for, you know, big companies, you know, a subsidiary of eBay, you know, they don't always have good communication. So, I mean, it affects organizations of all sizes, ultimately.
What are some of the other accomplishments that you see that the board is making?
I think having a stable, reliable foundation is one of the largest accomplishments that we've been able to do. Other accomplishments that we've done is made agreements with companies in other countries that you know, wish to sell Gen 2 merchandise are allowed to do such in a legal way that they're not, you know, violating, you know, any of our, you know, information or anything like that. You know, it's very much so that, you know, people are actually knowing that there's actually a body to communicate with and discuss these marketing and, you know, business-related activities with, instead of kind of, you know, hitting up a random developer and kind of bouncing around and never really getting a satisfactory answer. Beyond that, I think other accomplishments that we've done is that, you know, we've slowly been improving our communication because we publish our meeting logs. You know, we try to be openly discussed as much as we can. A lot of it's just through the IRC channel, which, yes, we need to improve and kind of do periodic news releases on the websites. You know, it's something that, again, needs work, but, you know, something that kind of shows that, you know, we are making progress slowly and, you know, we're trying and, you know, it's just a long, slow process. And, you know, it's a learning experience for everyone involved, ultimately. I mean, personally, I've learned more about the banking system, the FDIC, state governments than I ever knew before becoming a trustee. So, but we've also have an international board as well, whereas previously it was all North American based. So, I mean, Nnedi Sigun is based out of the UK. So, you know, we've become on our board also an international organization. Which, you know, has its own ramifications because, you know, you have to sign documents that are, you know, legal in the U.S. and as international, you know, you're basically agreeing to things that, you know, you'll be held accountable in foreign countries. So, you know, there's all sorts of interesting things like that, you know, no one, you don't think about and aren't really thought of as accomplishments, but in all reality, they are, because just, wrangling through all the laws and all that kind of stuff that affect, ultimately, an international organization of developers, because, we've got developers from, North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Australia. It's just an interesting thing, so.
What are some of the short-term goals for the foundation, for the board, in the next, let's say, coming up year?
I think a budget for spending some of the money that we have is definitely on the goals for that. I think continued working with businesses and retailers, to form, partnerships or, work with them, or, to kind of do communication to a bigger extent. There's also a work in progress that we hope to become a 501c3. Currently, we're a 501c6. The difference being basically in the U.S., and this is unfortunately U.S. specific at this time, a 501c3, basically donations for individuals become tax deductible as well as for businesses. So, we obviously have sponsors who donate a decent amount to us. And, unfortunately, they don't get to write it off right now. So when we become a 501c3, they're able to write off, I believe it's something like 50% of the donations as a tax write-off. And everyone likes tax write-offs in the U.S.
Sure.
So, for our U.S.-based people and businesses, it has, some immediate benefits for them. And, hopefully, ultimately, there's also motivation for us for that, is that it's a benefit to us because it means people are hopefully more likely to donate and all that kind of stuff. So having better equipment for our developers to develop with, means less time they spend waiting for something to build and more time actually figuring out what, if anything's wrong, how to improve this, how to do this, anything like that. So I think that's kind of the main goals that we hope to do for the coming year. It's just the 501c3, having a true budget in place, and just continuing to develop relationships with, users and businesses.
You were talking about the board being a lot more stable now. I know Roy, that's Nettie Sagoon, has been the chairman for a while. How long does each board member serve on the board?
Currently, it's a 2-year term that they can serve, and then comes up elections again. Basically, it was an issue where, unfortunately, again, the business side is not very interesting to the vast majority of people. You also end up signing lots of legal documents, and you basically become accountable as well. And needless to say, that makes people nervous. So. That's why we kind of chose to extend the terms as well, because that ensures, stability as well.
Sure.
Currently it's a 2-year term.
What open source programs can you not live without at home and at work?
At work, remote desktop. I work in Windows environments, so that's obviously required. Evolution for Exchange integration, because we are an Exchange shop, so Evolution is very, very much needed. Samba, obviously, for CIFS shares and all that good stuff. Let's see what else. X, both at home and at work, browsing and all that kind of stuff kind of. I kind of like to have some pretty little graphics on websites and that kind of stuff. Nothing against links or, any other, command line based browser. But, kind of is nice to have occasionally, the full website. Firefox, being the main browser that I use. What else? I'm a ZSH user, so ZSH for my shell is definitely a benefit. URXVT for my console. At home, what would I say? Indispensable tools. BusyBox. I can't tell the number of times that has probably saved my butt because I've done something silly or stupid or done an oops and, you know, had to recover by using BusyBox's minimal, you know, set and having all of the nice, wonderful built-in tools into it that, you know, I couldn't use for whatever reason previously. So SSH, obviously, I'm a Linux admin, so, yeah, I deal with 30 or so Linux servers. So, you know, logging into all those boxes is very, very useful. I think that covers the main applications that I make use of a majority of the time. Yeah, I mean, there's other applications that I use at work, you know, IOSAT and, you know, debugging and utilities of that nature to kind of trend and track and all that kind of stuff. I mean, when it comes to tracking and trending, Cacti and Agios are ultimate must-haves at work. And I was actually recently done as a, completed actually as a international usage for our corporation. So, I mean, it was a decent-sized project to do, and as we're slowly making more and more use of it, more and more of our teams are using it. So our network team in Sunnyvale, actually, has started using Nagios and Cacti for monitoring and trending of all the network stuff. So, I mean, it's been very useful on some of the graphs that are produced from Cacti are actually sent to some of our developers who are a bit of bandwidth hogs. And it's kind of funny because came back after seeing the graphs and was kind of asked our network admin, and it was like, when can I actually do what I need to do? Because looking at it, I don't have the ability to do it anytime. So, you know, it gives us kind of insight into how people are doing stuff and kind of make recommendations on how to improve things. So I think that's really, actually at this point now, the main utilities that I can think of.
What open source programs would you like to see developed?
That's actually a really interesting one. For the most part, I'm a very, very simple user. As far as Linux goes, ultimately, I would love to see more corporate type of applications developed. There's a lot of programs that have ultimately just kind of fallen into the corporate space. Cacti, Nagios. Love Cacti, but it definitely has, you know, a basis, and a lot of corporations use it. But there's always features that are missing that you're kind of like, oh, I wish that was in there right now. And, you know, as a corporate person, you have 20 million other projects that you're doing, so you have no time to actually work on implementing that feature. So, I mean, just, yeah, ultimately, more things that allow you to interact with corporations more. I mean, I have a number of applications that are unfortunately either Windows-only based or, you know, developed, you know, only for Red Hat, and hacking those apart, unfortunately, takes a good while to get them to work on Gentoo or any other distribution. So, I mean, even recently, you know, the Google developers on Chrome for Linux and Mac, you know, issued, you know, complaint about, which is a very common complaint, is that there's no unified API kind of situation for graphics or anything like that. But, you know, you also have to decide GTK or QT, and then, you know, your sound system, you have, you know, Straight Alsa, you have a Pulse Audio now as well, which, you know, ultimately, it's trying to simplify, you know, sound, because, you know, you have the worst case scenario on certain sound devices where, you know, you pull up Alsa Mixer and you have you know, a bar that goes across, you know, 200 plus items, and you know, managing that is no simple feat. So, and you know, there's various other companies that have developed, you know, sound-based systems for Linux, and you know, it just kind of is something that I don't think there's ever going to be a really simple solution, because you know, you ultimately have to have a layer above, you know, where you have, you know, like GDK or Qt, and you know, the interpreted and pass commands to either engine, you know, correctly, or figure out a way to get, you know, both bodies to work together. So it's just kind of a seemingly impossible problem that I don't know how you're going to get the people to work there. And unfortunately, I don't think the classic bring the two sides together, bash their heads together, and hope they're able to come to some kind of conclusion is going to work in this case. You know, a easier to develop for businesses and corporations, you know, for their stuff. And, I mean, I have to say one of the benefits was the kernel-based driver development. That's been actually a very successful project, you know, for helping businesses develop drivers for that work on Linux, and then allowing either, you know, the kernel maintainers to continue to maintain it, or, you know, providing the ability for the actual, you know, business or corporation that produces the device to be able to maintain the drivers going forward. So, I mean, there's an example of successfully reaching out and working with corporations and getting more stuff integrated with Linux.
Yeah, I use a USB modem to connect to the internet at work because I don't have internet access. So I use this, and it's a Sierra modem. And the actual developer that developed the driver is an employee of Sierra, and I'm sure this happens a lot. And Sierra actually pays him to develop the drivers for the Linux kernel. As a Linux system administrator, what are your areas of expertise?
Definitely OS optimization. That would be one I would hope to be able to claim. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of an art more than a science, unfortunately. You know, ultimately, to tune the Linux kernel, depending on what your environment is, you have to be equal parts an artist and equal part kernel developer, almost. Because ultimately, unfortunately, there's a decent amount of stuff actually in the kernel that you can tweak and tune and modify, but it's just not well documented at all. So, I mean, you have, you know, settings like swappiness. I mean, a lot of settings that are useful are actually in proc VM sys. So you have swappiness, you have, let's see, there's min-free kilobytes. What else? I'm thinking of something else. I'd have to wander in and take a look at my laptop for the ones I'm thinking of. But it defines basically, dirty buffer ratios are one of the fun ones, actually, because, you know, as systems develop more and more memory, you know, you have a 5-10% ratio by default in current kernels that says, you know, 5% of what your physical memory is can be dirty at any given time. If you have a box with 128 gigs of memory, you know, 12 gigs of potential dirty data is a lot of data that you're going to have to write to the disk at some point. So, I mean, that's one of the settings that, you know, the developers of the kernel are looking at and being like, you know, at points where, you know, there's like a gig of memory, you know, max in systems, having a percentage actually made sense. But, you know, as we get boxes with 128 gigs, 256 gigs of memory, you know, having potentially huge amounts of data that need to be written to this just kills system performance. So.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just kind of a couple of the things that I've run into that, you know, for expertise is just looking at that kind of stuff, because ultimately not a lot of people end up looking at that, it seems like, because there's not a lot of discussion about it. I take a decent amount of look at file systems as well. So I've been following, you know, B3FS, extension 3, extension 4, you know, and kind of a lot of the discussions surrounding, you know, the way that, you know, the kernel handles disk writing and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's actually really, really interesting stuff. And I'll fully admit I don't understand all of it. But, you know, I can get the gist of it, you know, the vast majority of the time, and, you know, understand, you know, on top of that, a lot of the time as well. But there's still stuff that just goes into the low-level kernel, you know, code that I'm just like, I'm not that good in C. So definitely those. I'm also a storage administrator, so storage in the area that I tend to excel at. I've worked with a number of vendors, a number of products in, you know, the SAN and the NAS space, and, you know, one of the beauties of those is that ultimately if you've used one SAN or one NAS, you're ultimately familiar with all the others because ultimately they use different names for the same exact things. Unfortunately, there's stuff that's just never exactly clear, and you can blame it on marketing, you can blame it on developers, you can blame it on whatever you want, but on SAN systems, you have basically two different types of controller setups. You have an active-active controller setup and an active-passive. The active-passive is one controller is active, the other is passive, so while the second controller might accept requests, it passes it off to the first controller to handle actually, you know, pushing data back and forth and all that. Active-active, both controllers can handle any request and take care of it on their own. You know, there's benefits to either or, but, I mean, if you're looking at a straight performance aspect, I mean, active-active is the only way to go. And majority of the time, if you're talking about a SAN, your ultimate goal is the performance. So, I mean, it's just interesting when you get into the area where just performance is the goal, ultimately. And you spend a lot of time just kind of tweaking the settings, seeing what happens, being like, okay, we didn't really see an improvement with that. What happens if we change this one now? Or change the value, or do this or that. So it's a lot of time that you spend just kind of doing things because each environment, unfortunately, is different, and what works in one environment doesn't work in another. So.
How big of a test environment do you have to do all the testing to try out this new stuff?
I wish I had a test environment.
Mm-hmm.
My interaction ultimately resides with improving Oracle performance. We're an Oracle shop. It's kind of rough because the Oracle people have 9-plus instances that they use for development and all that, which reside ultimately on, depending on how you look on it, 2 servers. Those are the equivalent to the development servers that we have. And while they can go and break stuff and change stuff and do all that kind of stuff, at this point in time, I don't really have that ability or luxury.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time that I can really kind of at the moment, and we're trying to get that changed because our IT has been very, very small, unfortunately. It used to be about 2.5 years ago, a total of about, I think, 3 or 4 people in total that were IT for server administration and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, it was just apps people and, you know, Oracle DBAs and that kind of stuff that maintained the servers because they're just not enough server support people to handle Windows and Linux. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of been a slow change process to get changes to be able to be implemented and recognized and test and all that kind of stuff, and that's still an ongoing process. So, ultimately, right now, a problem actually has to come up to kind of suggest changes and try them and see if they improve. And there's been a number that have been allowed. Switching from CFQ to deadline, for instance, is one. But I mean, even with just the switch to deadline, you know, there's timeout values that you can adjust for when Reed's timeout, when Wright's timeout, and all that. So I mean, there's still more testing even after implementing a change of what you can do with that one change to improve it even further. So it's a work in progress, and you know, it's slow and steady. And in the meantime, I do research and try to figure out ways to get it so that the Oracle people kind of either go along with it, or at least say, well, Oracle doesn't recommend this, so we're not going to do it at all. Mm-hmm. So, and unfortunately, I think any of your users who, well, listeners actually, who have worked in Oracle shops and anything like that will get a laugh out of that, because I've never been in an Oracle shop that hasn't been that way, where if it's not recommended by Oracle, well, we're not doing it.
Mm-hmm. So. What do you think about the Sun taking over Oracle?
That's actually a really interesting move for Oracle. I mean, it makes a lot of sense because Oracle is so entrenched with Java that, you know, keeping it alive and basically being able to push more of what they want into it makes absolute business sense. And, you know, I'm curious what they'll do with the hardware business side of it. For the Sun servers, the Sun fiber channel, you know, switches and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, Sun has always been kind of a niche kind of market, I would say. You know, I've worked with, you know, Sun servers before, and they're nice, but, you know, it's, you know, you think about the cost, and, you know, I'm like, I can buy 10 servers for the price of that one Sun box. So.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's much easier to be like, I'd rather have the 10 servers.
Mm-hmm.
So on that aspect, I'm not sure what they're going to do, but on the Java side, it makes entire sense. And it looks like Sun has done some testing of the waters on what they can, Oracle has done some testing on what they can get away with, because they did that change to the new garbage collector for Java. They rescinded on it and said, you know, you can use the new garbage collector, but you know, if you don't have a support contract, well, you know, it's kind of like you're kind of out of luck. Don't use it in production in that case. So I don't know. It's just something that I think is worth keeping an eye on, because Oracle is kind of the 10,000-pound beast. I mean, you know, they've got, well, quite frankly, the vast majority of DBs out there. I mean, you have MySQL, they got Oracle. I mean, it's just kind of interesting. And, you know, as far as the MySQL goes, it's actually worrisome because of just all the forks that have happened because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of the things to love about open source, and one of the things to hate at the same time, is that you have this ability to take the code and run with it an entirely different way from what everyone else is doing. But when you do that on, you know, such a major project, because, you know, so many shops use MySQL, so many shops, you know, use it and make use of it and use it for this or use it for that, you know, when you fracture and splinter the community, you know, it just kind of leaves you to wonder, you know, what's going to happen at that point. So
MySQL, the original guy that, I guess, developed it, they've branched off. I see now they got a called Maria.
Yep, there's like Maria, there's Drizzle, there's, but I in a way, I'm kind of worried, because I suspect that at least the main, you know, the main MySQL is going to die a slow death, and that, you know, something like Drizzle or, you know, one of the other forks, you know, that has, you know, like, couple of the main developers of what was the MySQL DB is going to take over the place and what most people are going to use. So.
Right.
And add in, you know, the fact that I think it'll give people pause and consideration to switch to Postgres as well. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's ultimately one of the benefits is you have choice. So, but you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I'm definitely glad I'm not a DBA right now. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, just keeping up on all of them and deciding on which one you need or want to use and is healthy is, I think, almost in a sense a full-time job in and of itself at this point in time.
Yeah, well, it's so involved. For me, it's so involved. I just do it as a hobby. But, you know, once I learn the commands, like my SQL, I've learned those commands. And so I get kind of stuck in, you know, using it for all my little projects that I do. What would be your dream job?
It's kind of funny because ultimately I think I'm one of the lucky people who would say I'm doing my dream job. I'm an assistant administrator.
Right.
Basically, vast majority of the time, I go to work and I get to have fun at work.
Uh-huh. Fantastic.
You know, it's just ultimately fun majority of the time at work. I mean, I log into Windows and deal with Windows stuff more often than I want to, but, you know, and I curse Microsoft occasionally, but, you know, for the most part, you know, I get to work on Linux and, you know, kind of learn it better and tweak it and just understand at a lower level a system that, to me, is a quite amazing system.
What are your thoughts on a Gentoo project leader, like a benevolent dictator, appointed for a term by the trustees and the Gentoo Council?
This is all going to be personal. This is definitely not going to be the official stance from a trustee. And yeah, it's odd because I kind of do have to make that distinction. Personally, I can see the benefit to it, but again, you would need people, at least the vast majority of people, to agree to that leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as I had mentioned earlier, we are so fractured as a community, going in so many different directions that, you know, getting enough people to concur and agree would be difficult. So, you know, I'm not sure if I'm, you know, benevolent dictator, but you know, maybe the council, because people have kind of settled and accepted the council now, you know, as the technical governing board for Gentoo. Having them kind of provide a direction, I think, would be the better alternative right now than having a single benevolent dictator.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even that would be difficult because, you know, people are resistant to being told kind of where you're going and where you want to go when we're all ultimately volunteers. You know, no one's
right.
paid to do this, so, you know, they'll work when they want to work, and they'll work on what they want to work on. You know, it's one of the benefits of being totally open source and come as you want and go as you want and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it works for other projects, you know, to an extent. OpenBSD and the BSDs have done very well with that kind of a model. But they're also slightly different in how they go about things as well than, you know, Linux. And, I mean, you take a look at Ubuntu and, you know, that one works well in part because of the financial backing and people are paid to work on this or that, and you have the so-called benevolent dictator who is the financial backer of the entire distribution, so... but, I mean, in Red Hat, same kind of way, you know, you have your CEO, you have your, you know, corporate board that, you know, everyone else is paid, so. So, I mean, and you know, Fedora being, you know, a branch of you know, Red Hat, again, they have people at Red Hat who are paid to work on Fedora, so,
mm-hmm.
are the leadership for it, so. Ultimately, I think... the only way we can do it is to get people to agree to, you know, have a direction and, you know, ultimately work our way towards that, whichever funky way we work towards it. And it's not going to be a clear cut, you know, A, B, C to Z. But, you know, we might go from A to 1 to 6 to 2 to B to Z eventually. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way that we'll be able to do it. So kind of weird roundabout way to answer it, but I think ultimately it just relies on leveraging the council to kind of further its technical role in providing a technical direction, as long as it doesn't violate the nature of Gentoo as a distribution.
Yeah, it seems to me that being the foundation has gotten a lot more stable, and that it's going to help the council.
Hopefully, yeah. I was going to say, we have a number of people who do a decent amount of work within Gentoo who are also on the council. And, you know, that's very much a benefit because, you know, I mean, making technical decisions, it should be, you know, key people who understand Gentoo on many, many different levels, you know, how it interacts together, how it works and all that. So, you know, there's obvious benefit to that. And just communication for the council members is also key as well, to just understand all the different aspects of the technical side. So, but yeah, I certainly have high hopes for the council and continue to have, you know, high hopes for them. And, you know, I've seen that over the last couple of years, the improvements, you know, there's been more GLIPs in the last few years than there had been in quite a long time. PMS standards, ultimately, I think, are a very good idea in what they're trying to accomplish, being, you know, a standard-based API, you know, based around, ultimately, e-builds and all that, to allow developers to develop other package managers that interact with each other, that you can easily switch from one to another. And you have, you know, different distributions that use different package managers, you know, that are so ultimately, you know, based off of Gentoo, but, you know, developed in slightly different ways. But you could easily move from one system to one distribution to another just by changing the package manager. So I think there's, you know, it's one of the things that Gentoo has always been kind of called a meta distribution. In that sense, because it allows you to do so much and make your own system your own, that we're slowly seeing that more and more based off of stuff like the PMS standards and that kind of stuff, allow, you know, a wider development in, you know, varying different ways with different programming standards, with different, you know, ideas that still ultimately allow you to switch between one and the other without any issues. So I mean, that kind of stuff gives me hope and shows the slow maturity of Gentoo as well.
Mm-hmm. So, what can users do to improve Gentoo?
This is the same thing I think almost everyone will say, is get involved. There's lots of different ways to get involved. Putting in bugs for stuff that breaks is one of the easiest ways to do it. We all use software, you know, we use different settings, all that kind of stuff, and, you know, it breaks your compiling. Well, you can, you know, provide, you know, hop on debugs.gentoo.org and, you know, put in a bug or do a search first to see if someone else has it and kind of add comments or feedback and all that. And there's documentation about how to do a good bug report as well. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, everyone always says about Gentoo is that we have excellent documentation. And it's an area that is always in need of more help. I was going to say, I mean, you know, we have documentation for how to set up, you know, mail servers. We have documentation for setting up Fiber Channel, actually, now. You know, we have documentation for installing OS. We have documentation for, you know, working with Emerge, but, you know, stuff like that can also use updates and changes and that kind of stuff, and, you know, our documentation team can always benefit from other people giving input into that. So, you know, it doesn't always have to be contributing code, it doesn't always have to be, you know, getting involved, becoming a developer. You know, everyone has a strength that they have, You know, some people it's writing, some people it's reviewing stuff, some people it's, you know, using their system to test, you know, a setup, you know, and even a simple, I can confirm this and I can work with you, and, you know, if you tell me what you need done, I can go out and do it and report back results. Because not always can, you know, developers who maintain a package, you know, get the ability to replicate a bug.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can, and you can provide assistance even to the developer and say, I have the ability to test this, I have the ability to do whatever you request of me, you know, majority of the time a developer will, you know, come back and be like, great, thank you. Can you try this?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you want it off, come back and say, this is what this came back with, this is what this came back with, this is what this came back with. You have this interaction and this community, you know, aspect where developers and users are working together to resolve an issue that, you know, maybe a developer can't replicate, but you can, and you can help resolve that issue. You might not be the one who actually writes the code to fix it, but you help however many people who have the issue or and didn't report it, or, you know, all the people who reported it and CC some of themselves to the bug. So, I mean, those are just some of the ways to get involved. I mean, ultimately, as I said, you know, we're a fractured nature in a lot of ways. So, you know, you know, people think of the common things to help out, you know, being, you know, documentation, being posting bugs, being writing code. But, you know, say someone's not an expert in any of those, but, you know, as a graphic designer. Okay. I mean, obviously, you know, we can make use of a graphic designer somehow. People love new icons, you know, the new splash screen, something like that. You know, just whatever your expertise is, I'm sure there's a way that you can leverage your skills to help out. And, you know, you just need to talk to people, ultimately, about it. And, you know, and ultimately, I like to say that Gen 2 developers are ultimately a friendly bunch. Majority of the time, we are. We all have bad days. But, you know, if you kind of say, you know, I want to help out in this way, you might get bounced around a little bit because you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of, you know, like an application issue, and you kind of need to go over to this group of people, and, you know, you might get bounced around to someone else, and, you know, I know that's frustrating, but, you know, we're trying to help, ultimately, too, because we don't always know who the right person is to talk to about that, and, you know, it's just the fun of being in Gen 2 is, you know, in this strange sort of way, you get to know all sorts of people all over the world and chat with them, because ultimately, you know, they weren't the person that you were supposed to talk to, but you end up talking to them anyways. So.
Yeah, I've noticed that if you're persistent, then if you keep asking, it's almost like you build up a little bit of trust within the community, that the community kind of gets to know you a little bit. And once they've seen you around a couple times, then they're more likely to, you know, talk to you some more, because I guess, you know, a lot of times people are busy and they don't know this person from a hole in the wall, basically. So if you just keep hanging around long enough, it might only take a few times of prodding, but then you'll get their attention and then you'll start getting some answers.
Exactly. And I fully understand that's frustrating for people. You know, a lot of people ultimately, you know, they want to ask a question, get the answer right away kind of type of stuff. And, You know, we all have limited patience, and ultimately asking people to be more patient is, you know, kind of sucky, but...
What gives you the most enjoyment within the Gen 2 community?
I still find enjoyment in the fact that I still consider the stable architectures, AMD 64, x86, to be in better shape than they were even 2-3 years ago. Again, that doesn't back in with corporate-related stuff, because, you know, having a stable environment where you know that when you merge something and compile it, it's going to install and work instead of, you know, running into an issue where, you know, something's not going to compile, or, you know, something breaks, you know, after installing or whatever. So that knowledge still still brings me a lot of enjoyment. Currently, it's getting the banking stuff squared away is bringing me enjoyment because each step forward that I make and is, I feel is progress. Makes me feel a lot better. It's as I said, I mean, it's been ongoing for months and months and months, unfortunately. It's definitely frustrating, and I've more than once vented my, disappointment or just, ugh, I need more documentation or something like that, but get over that hurdle, and there's always a sense of accomplishment. You know, it might not be, you know, everything's all done yet, but, you know, as long as there's, you know, some form of steady, continual progress, that's the right trend. So, and I think, ultimately, I think that's what everyone's looking for within Gentoo who works on it, is just kind of a steady, continual progress. You know, it might be, you know, the sense of bumping this package from version 1.12 to 1.13, but, you know, that maintains the current version of the package in the tree, and, you know, it's progress for people. Beyond that, I still enjoy interacting with users. Unfortunately, I do not have as much time as I used to do that. As all of our lives get busy and all that kind of stuff, unfortunately, you know, as more responsibilities come and go. Talking to users and, you know, finding out their user experiences and, you know, just finding that they enjoy and have learned from Gentoo, ultimately is kind of the biggest sense of accomplishment that I can ever have within Gentoo. It's, you know, being a part of helping someone else grow.
Thank you, Joshua, for the interview. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem. It was my pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, and also I want to give you a big thanks for everything you've done for Gentoo in the past and what you continue to do for Gentoo.
Thank you. It's appreciated. Actually, speaking of that, that's another thing that users can do that's really, really simple. It doesn't take a lot of work is to just say a thank you to, you know, the maintainer of a package that you use all the time. You can take a look at the metadata and, you know, ultimately just thank the developer or the, the group that maintains that package. You see it posted on, on stuff fairly often is that, unfortunately, developers are almost in a way a thankless job.
Right,
so,
negative, yeah. All you hear is the complaints and how come this isn't working.
Yep, unfortunately. And it wears down on everyone. That can cause, people to have a bad day. So, I mean, if nothing else, just occasionally thank the person who, maintains the package that you use most often, or, thank a different developer once a week, or, even if it's a program that you wrote that, takes a list of developers and, sends a thank you letter to a different one each week. It's still something that will make someone smile. So, and make them want to work on Gentoo that little bit extra or that kind of stuff. So, it's silly, but those kind of, even those small acts mean so much to people. And we never recognize that small non-script things that you don't think of ever are the biggest factors in people's happiness when they're doing something with their free time. So sorry to get off track again.
That's okay. That's what it's all about. Thanks again, Joshua. I'll see you on IRC.
Not a problem. Have a good day.
You too, man. Bye.
Bye-bye.